From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
We believe that our problem is one not of violation of civil rights, but a violation of human rights. Not only are we denied the right to be a citizen in the United States, we're denied the right to be a human being. It's a human problem, not an American problem or a Negro problem. And as a human problem or a world problem, we feel that it should be taken out of the jurisdiction of the United States government and the United States courts and taken into the United Nations in the same manner that the problems of the black man in South Africa, Angola, and other parts of the world, and even the way they're trying to bring the problems of the Jews in Russia into the United Nations because of violation of human rights.
That was the late Malcolm X talking with the press after returning from a trip to Africa, where he sought the assistance of the members of the Organization of African Unity to develop a case against the U.S. at the United Nations over the denial of basic human rights to African Americans. Tuesday marked the 90th anniversary of his birth. We'll have more on that later in this newscast. The power relations at the UN reflect those that existed 70 years ago as a consequence of the outcome of World War II. The victors, the U.S., the U.K., France, the USSR, and China, were given permanent seats on the Security Council with the power to block any action by the UN with their veto power. But that arrangement is coming under increasing scrutiny, as Press TV's Coletta Wanjohi reports.
Civil society organizations argue that while the world is changing, the United Nations Security Council is not. They want the council to be reformed so that the power held by only France, the US, Britain, China, and Russia be distributed to all countries in the world. The campaign is dubbed Elect the Council. The Elect the Council initiative intends to support member states in their efforts to pass a resolution by the UN General Assembly to expand the Security Council over a period of 15 years. Their argument is that with a crucial veto power in the hands of only five states in the world, decisions coming out of the Council are lacking in legitimacy and efficacy.
A number of the P5 members, the France and the United Kingdom, for example, are only there because they won a war 70 years ago. They are no longer global powers, and their power is declining. We face new challenges, and we argue that legitimacy and effectiveness are two sides of the same coin. You can't only have a small group of countries with a veto power that comes from 70 years ago.
The reforms suggest that the Council be expanded to 24 seats, of which 8 countries would be elected for 5 years, and 16 countries would be elected for 3-year terms. Africa already has a seat in the UN Security Council. African countries have already made it clear that they want a minimum of 5 seats at the Council, 2 of which should be permanent seats with the veto power.
We have always been advocating for an open and transparent Security Council with, you know, elections, with accountability and so on. I think it's, of course, a backlog which has been dating back to, many years, and negotiations have been going on for a long time. But maybe there's a new momentum now and we can make some progress, who knows.
The United Nations Security Council was established by 51 countries 70 years ago. The organization today has 193 member states that coexist, compete, and cooperate in a world that is very different from 1945. Coletta Wanjohi for Press TV in Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa.
And a recent meeting of the Committee of 10 African Countries, tasked to press for reforms of the UN, urged changes to allow the organization to adapt to the current geopolitical realities. CCTV's Farai Umwakatua was in Zambia for the meeting and filed this report.
Africa is the only continent that doesn't have permanent representation on the UN Security Council. The continent wants the powerful group expanded, but it's not happening quickly enough. Yet Africa is often more than 70% of the Council's agenda.
Without addressing this grave discrepancy, the United Nations risks negating the gains of its 70 years of advancing democracy, equity, and inclusiveness.
Progress in pushing for the reforms had been stalled, but when Uganda's Sam Kutesa chaired the 69th session of the UN General Assembly this year, he used the opportunity to revive the debate.
We will take our rightful place in the Security Council. Our rightful place includes seats in the permanent representation category, and our rightful place demands that if our permanent representations from other regions have veto powers, Africa's permanent representatives must have veto powers.
Africa needs the support of 128 UN members to get a permanent seat, and crucially, the buy-in of the five permanent Security Council members, commonly referred to as P5. Zambia and Uganda have jointly been reaching out to them. Of the five, only China has previously expressed its openness to admitting Africa without conditions. The Livingstone Summit says Africa's time has come.
Africa will continue to canvass the support of the member states to correct injustice and inequity within the UN system.
It's the sort of determination that is required in the face of stiff resistance.
Africa has been walking this road for 10 years now, and though there have been hurdles along the way, leaders meeting in Livingstone are determined that 2015 will be the watershed to address what they call a political and moral imbalance. Farai Mwakutuya, CCTV, Livingstone.
Out of work and looking for a job? The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is hiring. With more on that, we have this report from RT.
Saudi Arabia is looking for 8 more state executioners. A job offer has been published on a civil service website, according to media reports. The job description says no special training is needed for the job. The executioners would be required to behead condemned criminals in public, as well as carry out amputations on those convicted of lesser offences. They would be serving religious courts and be paid at the lower end of the civil service pay scale. Now, this recruitment drive comes as the number of executions in Saudi Arabia is spiking. Last year, it executed an estimated 90 people. That figure has almost been matched already in 2015. Sivak Keshishyan is Amnesty International's expert on Saudi Arabia. He told me the West's being hypocritical when it comes to human rights issues in the monarchy.
We know for a fact that many executions take place in Saudi Arabia after grossly unfair trials, typically based on simply confessions that are typically extracted under torture.
Okay, let's just turn to the words that we heard after the loss of the late King Abdullah, some of the things we heard from Western leaders at that time. Let's listen in.
Obviously, we have extraordinary respect for His Majesty and his leadership. I had a great relationship with King Abdullah, who was deeply missed.
He was a great leader, implemented lots of reforms at home, and in a very discreet way, he was a strong advocate of women.
Well, they weren't the only ones. Britain's Prime Minister David Cameron said the King will be remembered for his commitment to peace and strengthening understanding between faiths. Back to you, Sivak. Do you think Western leaders are deliberately turning a blind eye to Saudi Arabia's poor human rights record? If so, why?
Well, the answer is absolutely yes. There's no other explanation. I mean, you look at the human rights record of the country, it's abhorrent. Basically, no one dares to criticize publicly Saudi Arabia. And that is, in a way, the result of many things, including, obviously, the interests that Western governments have with Saudi Arabia. So it's absolute hypocrisy. There's no doubt about it. When it comes to criticizing Saudi Arabia, no one would dare. They would typically say, well, we're sort of raising these issues, what they would call through silent diplomatic means, as in behind closed doors. But the point is that silent diplomacy doesn't seem to have done anything, absolutely nothing, since the last couple of years that we've been hearing the line.
The UK military whistleblower who revealed that Great Britain is under a threat of nuclear annihilation, not from Russia or China, but from its own nuclear weapons, has turned himself in to authorities. RT's Polly Boyko has more.
William McNeely went absent without leave from the Faslane naval base after he'd published that online report, the crux of which claims that the UK's nuclear deterrent Trident is, quote, a disaster waiting to happen. And in a Facebook post, quite a lengthy one actually, yesterday afternoon, he wrote that he'd been on the run for days, that he'd had to use fake names and that he'd had to change locations a number of times, but that he lacked the resources to remain undetected. The Royal Navy also said that they disagree with McNeely's subjective and unsubstantiated personal views. It's not yet clear what McNeely's fate is going to be. He did talk about it in that lengthy Facebook post yesterday.
Prison would be such a nice reward for sacrificing everything to warn the public and government.
Generally, the experience of public servants blowing the whistle and trying to highlight wrongdoing, it hasn't been an easy one in the past for the people that have tried to tread this path already. Recently, for example, in the Metropolitan Police, senior officers tried to silence a fellow colleague who tried to blow the whistle on the fact that the force was basically fiddling its crime figures. So they tried to gag him, but also this officer got the sack as well. And similarly, in the National Health Service recently, there was a government report that said that some workers have been brought to the brink of suicide as a result of bullying after they try to highlight wrongdoing within the health service. One doctor recently, Dr. Hayley Dare, she was sacked from her job and then sued by her employer, the West London Mental Health Trust. So in theory, the laws here do seem to encourage whistleblowing. It's seen as an important tool in society to highlight wrongdoing. But in practice, what seems to happen is slightly different.
Tuesday marked the 90th anniversary of the birth of Malcolm X. To mark the date, we asked Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford what he thought was Malcolm X's greatest legacy.
Well, for me, Malcolm's biggest contribution was legitimizing critiques of the emerging Black leadership of his day. Remember, in 1963, many folks, Black and white, were just meeting, seeing, viewing the emerging Black leadership, which was called the Big Six, the folks who had come together for that March on Washington, and that was the NAACP and the SCLC, the Martin Luther King's organization, CORE, the Young SNCC, A. Philip Randolph, the Urban League, and these people constituted what the corporate media recognized as being the Black leadership of the day, but not Malcolm X's Black leadership. He called them derisively the Big Six. He called the March on Washington a farce on Washington, and in doing that, he opened a dialogue on where this new movement was going. He aired dirty linen, that is, critiques of Black movements and organizations and personalities in public. He'd go on white media to talk about these folks, making it credible to have this kind of conversation without worrying that the white folks might be listening. When he used his vehicles, such as his stories about the House Negro and the Field Negro, these were devices to wage political battle against, well, quite often, the Big Six, deriding them, belittling them, calling them a House Negro, somehow aligned with the white power structure. So he made it legitimate for others in the Black community to question those who were being put forward as our leaders. And that created a culture of criticism, of critique, an open debate in the Black community that I think gave birth to that fertile culture of struggle that we know as the 60s. These great debates that led to great power struggles and great victories for our people. In fact, that was the decade in which we had our greatest victories, even though we had very, very few Black folks in elected office. And Malcolm set the tone for that.
Transporting that to today, do you think that critique would be relevant?
More relevant than ever. We remember 2007 and 2008 and 2009 when it was verboten, taboo, sometimes dangerous to criticize this corporate Democrat, Barack Obama. Malcolm, of course, would have had no hesitation in telling the folks exactly what he thought about Obama and the Big 43, the Congressional Black Caucus, and the residue of the old 60s Big Six as well. We would have had a healthy critique and debate in the black community, something that was absolutely absent just a few years ago and is only now coming into a kind of life.
And finally, the Black Agenda Report frequently, the contributors there, yourself, Bruce Dixon, Margaret Kimberly, others, refer to the black misleadership class of today. Is this an heir to the critique of Malcolm, you think?
We are Malcolm's children. At least we hope to be worthy of being Malcolm's children. We try to carry on the legacy that he made legitimate in the early 1960s.
We also spoke with former six-term member of Congress and 2008 Green Party presidential candidate Cynthia McKinney about Malcolm X's effort to bring the U.S. before the U.N., over its serial violations of the human rights of African Americans.
Well, that's very interesting because it was 2011 when the United States started its bombing of Libya. The Libyan Jamahiriya had just held a conference that was saying to Africans all over the world in the diaspora, if you cannot live in dignity where you are, then come back to Africa and help us to build Africa. And Malcolm's dream of taking the treatment of blacks in the United States before the United Nations was a dream that was never realized. And yet, at the same time that it wasn't realized in the way that Malcolm envisioned it, we are experiencing the Universal Periodic Review, I believe is what it's called, when every 4 years, the human rights situation of member states of the United Nations is reviewed. And of course, the United States is also under review. So we could say that one of the ways in which Malcolm's dream has been realized is that the United States is under review of the UN for the situation of human rights in the United States.
Well, among the items listed in the periodic review were extrajudicial killings in the United States and the mass incarceration, primarily in each case of people of African-American descent.
Yes, and it's my understanding that an extremely blistering report has been issued for the situation that occurs with particularly young African-American men and other young men of color in the United States with the police shootings. The Malcolm X grassroots movement recently concluded a study, and they found that every 28 hours, there is a young African-American male who is killed by the police or by someone acting as a security officer.
And then Malcolm's, the body of Malcolm's complaint that would have been brought at the time didn't include the phenomenon of mass incarceration of black males, because that phenomenon didn't in fact exist yet.
Well, in many respects, you could say that the situation has gotten worse. You know, at least in Malcolm's day, there was a vibrant movement of which he was a leader, and that movement was pressing for rights on all fronts. And basically, the United States was, while it was a singular superpower in the world, it was in the position of losing its moral authority, losing its moral standing in the world. And people were aware of the transgressions of the United States and viewed the African-American community in the United States as victims of imperial power on the inside, as outsiders were victims of U.S. imperial aims on the outside.
And there's been an interesting dynamic in Africa since the destruction of Libya. Many people believe that, with some good cause, I think, that Muammar Gaddafi was targeted and Libya was targeted by the United States as a way to soften the ground for the introduction of AFRICOM to the continent. Libya, after the revolution in 1969, had kicked the United States out of its last base on the African continent. And it wasn't until after Libya was destroyed that the AFRICOM project reached what's now more than 35 countries where it has command and control. After, I guess it's 4 years and change now after that's happened, suddenly we see this year the African Union electing Robert Mugabe as the chair of the AU. Do you think that there's a swing around in the sentiment of on the African continent towards a stronger position for self-determination and sovereignty?
I think the election of Robert Mugabe as leader of the African Union is clearly an anti-Western domination vote. And it has to be construed as such. Even when you have someone as bought and paid for as Zuma in South Africa, who is proclaiming that the West just doesn't realize that Africans are no longer their slaves, you know, there's something that's going on the continent is not nearly enough. And I support the young people on the African continent who are increasingly impatient with the leadership or lack thereof that they have, these people who are put in positions of power to represent them and really to block them from achieving their true goals of self-determination and sovereignty and independence and freedom. So something is changing. It just hasn't changed enough. The presidency of Barack Obama at the same time, it is interesting that one of the most severe periodic reviews would come from the administration of the United States' first African-American president. And that tells us something about how certain segments of the community have been co-opted into a Western domination, European supremacy, Eurocentric kind of policy tool, instead of actually being forces for change and liberation that I think a lot of people in the United States, not just in the African-American community and the Latino community, but many people across the board are waiting for.
And you just finished your dissertation on transformative leadership and using the example of Hugo Chavez. In Latin America, Caribbean region, Chavez set in motion a dynamic towards assertion of sovereignty and regional integration that has become so powerful that it has even drawn in those countries whose leadership is otherwise oriented towards the U.S. and neoliberalism. Is it possible that someone like Mugabe could set in motion a similar dynamic on the African continent?
Well, you know, this is why the cabal, that little small group of people who try to control the world, don't really trust people and always have a guardian next to, the leader. Like, for example, Dick Cheney was to George W. Bush as Joe Biden is to Barack Obama. You know, there's always this in Morgan down in Zimbabwe to Mugabe. So there's always this second person who is totally enamored of Western domination and benefits from it. The reason there's this lack of trust is because ultimately I think the human condition is that people want to be free. And whether you're a full slave or just a little bit of a slave, you still want to be free. And I think that there's always a possibility of a rebellion if the climate is right. And so we have to be not weathermen and weatherwomen just, you know, reporting what the weather is, but our role is to actually create, do a little geoengineering and create the correct environment so that people can express their natural desire to be free.
And finally, within the context of the emerging BRICS block, it's actually becoming a block. You no longer have a monopolar world. Is there space for the African Union to quickly organize itself and start dealing in bloc politics and trading itself in?
Well, you know, this is what the Non-Aligned Movement was all about. And before the Non-Aligned Movement, there was the Afro-Asian Bloc. And basically, the Afro-Asian Bloc said, okay, we Africans and we Asians are going to come together and we're going to fight colonialism. And they did. And the Afro-Asian Bloc was the basis, the foundation of the Non-Aligned Movement and all of the other organizations that were anti-colonial that exist up until and including today. And so we could go back, we can look at the BRICS as just the newest development in the anti-European domination situation of global control. BRICS really is an outgrowth of the duality of the Russian identity. You know, those who know Russian history know that for a large part of Russian history, Russia was not only treated as the country bumpkin cousin by the Europeans, but Russians also tried to overcome that by becoming as European, particularly as French, as Europeans were. And what BRICS is the culmination of is an understanding that while they might be situated in Europe, the Russians are also situated in Asia. And I think what we're witnessing now is the growing confidence of Russians, not running after, chasing behind, trying to be like the Europeans, but being fully comfortable in their Asian skin.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.